Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a warning about high-level decision-making by former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, that there are known unknowns and unknown unknowns, and discuss the current decision-maker in chief who does not know what he knows and does not know what he doesn't know. Stephen Nadler, a professor of philosophy at the University of Wisconsin, joins us to discuss the scary fact that Donald Trump is ignorant of his own ignorance. We will examine the ignorance of not just Trump, but also of his supporters, who he once proudly complimented, saying, "I love the poorly educated," and the change in American politics since the arrival of Sarah Palin as a candidate for high office, to assess the extent to which any kind of meritocracy is at play anymore in our politics, or do people vote for someone they want to have a beer with rather than someone who is competent, knowledgeable, and experienced. Then we'll look into today's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee and speak with Jacob Halperin, a senior editor at the National Interest and author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. He joins us to discuss the White House's increasingly tortured denials about their collusion with Devin Nunes, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, to effectively drive the House investigation into a ditch, and whether the Senate investigation will be able to pick up the pieces. Then finally, we'll speak with National Security reporter Ali Watkins, who covers the Senate Intelligence Committee for BuzzFeed News, about the surprising testimony today of Clinton Watts, a senior fellow at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University, who testified that Russian hacking and fake news is still influencing our politics, and that Trump parroted Russian fake news and was susceptible to being fed fake news. And joining us now is Stephen Nadler, who's a professor of philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who recently served as editor of the Journal of the History of Philosophy. He's written extensively on Descartes and Cartesianism, Spinoza and Leibniz, and his books include Spinoza, A Life, The Best of All Possible Worlds, A Story of Philosophers, God and Evil, and The Philosopher, the Priest, and the Painter, A Portrait of Descartes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Nadler.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And in an article in the New York Times by Thomas Edsel, where Tom is talking about, in the context of former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld famously describing the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns. And you're quoted as saying, "President Trump seems to have no awareness whatsoever of what he does and does not know. He is ignorant of his own ignorance." So that's an alarming thought, but it does appear to be a fact.
Alarming indeed. I mean, it's one thing to not know what it is you're doing, but to approach the world situation unaware of what you do and do not know, and thus sort of blindly lashing out with this kind of epistemic arrogance, thinking that you know what you don't know, it's quite dangerous.
So, in effect, we have a lethal combination of unbridled arrogance and rank amateurism.
That's true. And what I intended to, the comparison I intended in my remarks to Mr. Edsel was with a character from one of Plato's first dialogues. The character's name is Euthyphro, and he's off to the law courts to prosecute his father for murder. And Socrates says, "Well, that's a very brash undertaking. Do you know what you're doing?" And it's clear throughout the dialogue that, in fact, Euthyphro has no idea really whether it's the right thing to do or not, because he has no idea what it means for something to be right. And so I think our President Trump should really be named President Euthyphro, because his own ignorance of his ignorance mirrors that of somebody who undertakes rash and consequential actions without really knowing whether they're the right thing to do.
So is it because he's just had a background in real estate and sales and promotion, where the truth is a moving target, that, you know, he doesn't know the difference between truth and fiction, because his whole pitch in life has been embellishment? That's what salesmen do. They seem to have a license to lie, do they not?
I think that's a very good point, although I wouldn't want to impugn an entire set of occupations. I think in this case, it's compounded by the fact that he has suddenly gained enormous power. And somebody who's used to being a salesman and really puts profit or self-interest over truth has to move forward and really doesn't want to devote time to examining what the proper action is to be. So it may be because he was a salesman. It may just be a personality disorder. It's hard to say. Well, actually, it's not so hard to say.
Well, I remember being quite shocked when John McCain nominated Sarah Palin as his vice president when she first appeared on the stage. It was shocking to hear somebody and listen and watch somebody that seemed to be so out of their depth. And to my mind, maybe John McCain has opened a floodgate here. It's not just that Donald Trump is ignorant and ignorant of his own ignorance. On the campaign trail, he said, "I love the poorly educated." And it does feel, and in fact, I think studies have been done about the breakdown of the vote. And it's pretty clear that the less educated Americans voted for Trump and the more educated Americans voted for Hillary Clinton. So go ahead.
When Sarah Palin was nominated for the vice presidential role, you thought, could it possibly get any worse than this? Well, we had no idea that it, in fact, could get quite worse. And I think there's a certain illiteracy now among the American public. Perhaps it's because of the sources from which people get their information, a lack or inability to reflect on those sources and assess their truth. It really puts American politics in a very sorry state.
Well, there were hearings today before the Senate Intelligence Committee where some cyber experts were talking about fake news and the proliferation of fake news, and in particular the use of fake news by Vladimir Putin and these troll farms that he's organized. And it looks like the intelligence people are zeroing in on a Russian troll farm that dedicated some 1,000-odd hackers to the elections to help Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. And in the context of the discussions before the Senate today, one of the witnesses said, you know, that this fake news went on through the campaign. It was used by Trump. Putin was feeding him stuff, and he was repeating it on the campaign trail. And he's repeating it today. And indeed, the Russian fake news people know when he's tweeting, and then they feed false stories, knowing that, if, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning, this, you know, King Lear characters wandering around the empty family quarters in the White House in his bathrobe, you know, tweeting because he's been watching stuff on TV until the early hours of the morning, getting more and more angry.
It's one thing to have to look at the particular case of an individual whose arrogance and ignorance combined with power and the danger of that. But what's more frightening is this sort of systematic disregard of truth and facts. And when Kellyanne Conway early some months ago indicated, well, that there are alternative facts, I think there was perhaps one of the more concerning aspects of this administration, that it will no longer be interested in scientific facts, philosophical facts, truth as we ordinarily understand it, but whatever seems convenient to the administration will now pass as a fact or truth.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Nadler, who is a professor of philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who recently served as editor of the Journal of the History of Philosophy. His books include Spinoza, A Life, The Best of All Possible Worlds, A History of Philosophers, God and Evil, and The Philosopher, the Priest, and the Painter, A Portrait of Descartes. So what then is the answer to the growing ignorance and the fact that we have a president who's the most powerful man in the world and doesn't know the difference between truth and lies, fact and fiction, and doesn't care? Well, do you think this is the sort of reductio absurdum of a downgrading of education over the decades? I mean, I might add that Trump has this habit of putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank, and he's put a clearly somewhat ignorant woman in charge of education. So is that the problem, that we basically, it's not just that Trump is out of his depth but doesn't care, but that in many ways the constituents that voted for him are also products of a failing education system?
I think that's a very nice way to put it. It is, in a way, a reductio ad absurdum of the de-emphasizing of secondary education, primary education, are learning about other cultures, the education in languages. And I would also just throw in a defense of the humanities. I mean, one of the things that you've seen over the last decade or so, especially in discussions of higher education, is how the humanities needs to make themselves relevant, and the greater number of resources being placed on STEM education. Well, in fact, it's the humanities like philosophy and history and literary studies that teach us how to be critical thinkers who are concerned about discovering the meaning of things and truth. And these are essential skills for an informed citizenship. And the less we emphasize that kind of intellectual training, not just in universities, but in high schools and primary schools, the less we can expect of our electorate, I think, and of our citizenship. You need to have well-educated citizens who need to be trained in critical thinking and how to assess evidence, how to make judgments of value, and how to lead practically informed lives.
So is this a result of the fact that education has shifted towards the notion that we have to educate people for the job market as opposed to educate them for life? And it's no accident that a lot of billionaires are now meddling in the education process, particularly Eli Broad out here in Los Angeles, who's almost single-handedly ruined the school system in Detroit, along with Betsy DeVos, who's tried to ruin it in Michigan and might well ruin it in the entire United States now that she's Secretary of Education. And of course, even people that are not considered to be total dilettantes in terms of being billionaires, Gates and others have also thrown themselves into this arena.
Yeah, I think you're seeing it happen at the level of university and college education and also in secondary education, that what's a liberal arts education is now being turned into mere vocational training. We're seeing it here in the high schools in Madison, where you're having these pathways which are narrowly focused on training for careers. I would also say that vocational training is good, but it shouldn't be neglected for the kind of education that makes for responsible citizenship. And, you know, I wouldn't say that we should value the humanities over the sciences, because I think one of the perhaps the most frightening aspect of this administration is the neglect and disdain for scientific truth. It's one thing to have in place policies that can be reversed by the next administration. But when you start messing up the planet because you couldn't care less about what climatologists and scientists are saying about the environment, then you're really messing up things in a way that it's hard to see how they can be reversed. So I would say we need to invest in the STEM education. We need to invest in humanities education. And only then can we, you know, think that we have a progressive educational system.
But when I first, as I mentioned earlier, first saw Sarah Palin, what alarmed me was the idea that people, my assumption has been that throughout the country's history, and of course it's worth remembering that the Founding Fathers initially only wanted men of property to vote, and I don't know whether that meant educated men, but it certainly meant wealthy men, and no women, and of course no slaves. But the notion that Sarah Palin brought up was that people are going to vote for people that are just like them, as opposed to the assumption that previously they voted for people that they thought were more educated and more capable.
Yeah, I, for one, would rather live in a country governed by elites. If by elite you mean people who know what they're doing, people who have the education. You know, there's been this trend in presidential elections recently that we want to see our president as somebody who we could have a beer with. I don't want my president to be somebody I want to have a beer with. I want somebody who knows enough about domestic policy, about world affairs. You know, there's also this idea that being president of the United States is just like running a business. Well, it's not like running a business, and we shouldn't be electing people whose only skills are corporate. When you're simply the CEO of a corporation, you don't have to worry about things like justice and fairness and safeguarding the environment and the right and rights and moral issues. There's actually very little, I think, carryover from simply being a CEO to being president of a large democracy.
Well, at this point, you know, even though the Trump administration has been completely chaotic, and some people are starting to see this, by the way, as being a little more sinister. It's not as if the Republicans aren't benefiting from the chaos coming out of the White House and the daily stories about what's, you know, more and more the drip, drip, drip of what's happening in terms of collusion between Trump and the Russians. But meanwhile, the Republicans are able to push through some extremely regressive, just on Tuesday, they allowed the big internet monopolies and cable monopolies to basically harvest your private information and sell it to the highest bidder. And that's just one example of what's going on. So there may be a kind of benefit to having the kind of clown in the White House, the sort of ringmaster who's distracting the people and the press from what's really mendacious on Capitol Hill. What do you think of that theory?
Yeah, I think that's quite plausible. I mean, there's two ways of looking at it. On the one hand, you can take comfort in the fact that they're so disorganized and so clownish that, thank goodness, they won't be able to get anything done. Or you can think of that as sort of the hand-waving and the smoke and mirrors distraction, while underneath it all, there's really dangerous things happening.
Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I hope that they're not as effective. But, you know, we have to be ever vigilant. Otherwise, they're going to get away with it all.
Well, though, I was about to say earlier that my concern is that in spite of the fact that the Republicans may be benefiting from the kind of chaos, it may be a cover for their mendacity in terms of getting a very reactionary agenda passed, which Trump will willingly sign, and whether it comports in any way with these campaign promises, that seems to be beside the point. But so far, we have not had an international crisis, and there could be at any moment a financial crisis or a terrorist incident. And so what happens then?
Your guess is as good as mine. He hasn't really been tested yet. It's one thing to send out these tweets and to sign executive orders left and right. But when you've surrounded yourself, and first of all, we do know that the government is currently vastly understaffed, and a lot of well-informed career professionals in international policy and environmental policy are not currently working in the administration. It's really hard to know what's going to happen when a real crisis comes up and serious decisions have to be made that don't involve tweets or quickly signed off executive orders. It's frightening.
So back to ignorance and Trump's being ignorant of his own ignorance. We talked about the possible causes in terms of the broader constituency, which is the American people and the decline of public education. Is there any way, short of reviving education and civics and the humanities, as you pointed out, which have been abandoned for this kind of vocational approach to education, if you can't fix that, and that's a pretty tall order, is there any way to sort of fix the idea that maybe as a people and as a culture, we should start respecting knowledge, expertise, truth, competence? In other words, become something of a meritocracy, which has always been the assumption that that's the part of the American dream. And as far as I can tell, you know, we don't really have a meritocracy except perhaps in the military.
I think that's very well put. The question is how do we get there? I think to the extent that the media are now a little more vigilant about calling out Trump on lies and highlighting the dangers of policies. I look at this as part of journalism's responsibility. You know, the old claim to neutral objectivity, that's always been a bit of a myth to begin with. But now more than ever, I think it's important for the media to alert citizens to the dangers we face. And by revealing the lies, the disinformation, the distrust of facts that's coming out of the White House and this administration hopefully will inspire citizens to turn back to history, to learn, you know, to study the Constitution, and to study policies rather than just going along.
Well, Stephen Nadler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Nadler, who's a professor of philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who recently served as editor of the Journal of the History of Philosophy. His books include Spinoza, A Life, The Best of All Possible Worlds, A Story of Philosophers, God and Evil, and The Philosopher, the Priest, and the Painter, A Portrait of Descartes. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into today's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jacob Harbron, who is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is Will Pax Germania Replace Pax Americana? Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Harbron.
Thank you.
In the hearings today before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, headed by Senator Burr and co-chaired by Senator Warner, obviously before the hearings, they showed that they were kumbaya moment. They talked about how cooperative they are with each other and how nonpartisan they operate. And that's, of course, in stark contrast to the Devin Nunes, his committee on the House side that's all but collapsed. Let's begin with that, because it would seem to me that was deliberately sabotaged, either by Nunes himself, although I don't think he's that bright. I think the White House helped collapse it more than anything. And I think they were more afraid of Adam Schiff than they are of Senator Warner. So what's your sense?
That may be, but I think that the Senate is a more important body and that the Trump approach has in fact backfired by focusing more attention on the Senate hearings. So I don't think there's anything so terrible about the House hearings collapsing.
Well, you think the Senate can, I mean, first of all, they had a very important hearing with Sally Yates, the former head of the CIA, Brennan, and the former DNI, General Clapper. That was canceled. That seems like something that the public could have benefited from.
Yes, but Yates can testify before the Senate, which I'm quite sure she will do. I don't think all that the Trump administration has done is to perpetuate the perception that there's a genuine cover-up taking place. The question that has to be on the mind of any concerned citizen is, if they have nothing to hide, why are they going to these extraordinary lengths, including the cloak and dagger visit of Nunes to the White House grounds, where we now know he received information from two National Security Council officials? Why didn't those officials supply the president directly with its information? Why did they go to Nunes? It's clear that they were trying to blow up the investigation. In blowing it up, they've only attracted more attention to their activities.
Well, what was extraordinary about what I guess is adds to that amazing situation is the efforts of the White House press secretary to sort of deny what's happening. And of course, the New York Times has identified these two White House officials. And for several days now, the reporters have asked Sean Spicer about who Nunes met with. And it's so easy because the White House records are clear. And it would take him, you know, about 30 seconds in a phone call to get the answers. And he kept sort of stonewalling them. And now that the New York Times has actually published these names, et cetera, Sean Spicer is now giving this bizarre denial, saying that, quote, if I start going down the path of confirming and denying one thing, we're going down a very slippery slope.
Well, there he just confirmed it, didn't he? But in his own way, Spicer has become the Baghdad Bob of the Trump administration.
Well,
he is willing to say anything on behalf of his president, but he shredded his credibility right with the inaugural photos. So what we're witnessing is an administration entangled in the coils of its own lies and mendacity.
Well, but is it because Spicer can't go to the boss? And, for example, the most outrageous lie and insult was Trump's tweet calling Obama a bad and sick guy, where he blamed Obama accused Obama of wiretapping him. And he's never come forth with any evidence. And now he's been refuted by the head of the FBI and just about everybody else. And nevertheless, Trump won't get out from under that lie, and neither will Spicer. And, you know, in the real world, a decent person and as press secretary would go to his boss and say, look, boss, you've got to come clean. This is unacceptable. So isn't that where the fault lies?
Yes, but you have to assume that there's something, if they're willing to go to these lengths, there must be something even worse that they're trying to hide. That's why they're creating the perception of a cover-up. And Trump, by the way, has not retracted, as far as I know, his claim that British intelligence was monitoring Trump at the behest of President Obama.
So back to the hearings today, Jacob Halperin. Clinton Watts, a senior fellow at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University, I thought was an extremely interesting witness. And he brought things very sharply into focus and very much up to date, where he mentioned that Senator Rubio, who was on the Senate panel, was hacked just yesterday, and that the Russians are still interfering in our political process, that they've been using hacking and social media and fake news to influence the recent debate over the healthcare bill replacement, repeal and replacement, driving a wedge between Republicans on this healthcare bill. So how did that strike you, that testimony?
Well, he is a very credible and persuasive witness. And I think his most damning accusation was that wittingly or unwittingly, Trump had repeatedly, during the presidential campaign, ventilated and spread Russian active measures. That Trump, in effect, was taking Russian propaganda and giving it new credibility in his speeches and pronouncements. And he indicated that the Russians are continuing to try and put information on the internet and on Twitter that they know at optimal times when they believe that Trump may see it and either retweet it or repeat it. So that was what I think truly confounded and appears to have distressed even the Republican senators that were at the hearing today.
Well, I mentioned Adam Schiff earlier being a threat to the White House. He, in fact, in an interview with NPR just a couple of days ago, made that point that Trump, of course, his defense has been, I have no deals in Russia. And Adam Schiff said the deals aren't in Russia. What we should be looking at are Russian deals here in America and with the Trump Organization.
Absolutely correct. And you're right that Schiff has been an extremely articulate and incisive questioner. And the Trump administration most likely does fear him. But I don't think they'll be able to sideline him completely, even if the investigation in the House has been demolished. He'll still be following this and commenting on it. And I don't think that the administration has in any way effectively been able to dispel the stench that is emanating from the White House. It just seems to get worse every day.
Well, I remember with Lewinsky, with Clinton wagging his finger and saying, I never had sex with that woman. And I never believed him because, you know, the old Shakespearean expression, he doth protest too much. If he hadn't had relationships with her and she'd made this false accusation, then a normal person would say, well, you know, she's obviously a very troubled girl and I don't want to comment on it. I think a family has to deal with this matter and move on. And the same thing applies to Trump. Here he is being accused, going well before the elections, and certainly in November, in October, and back in July, and we learned that Comey himself, the head of the FBI, wanted to even go public in July with the initial findings of Russian interference. But when it was very clear, when all the intelligence, 17 of them, came to a consensus, if Trump was a reasonable person and was innocent, he would have basically, at that point, wanted to clear the air. And frankly, I don't understand why Obama didn't let Comey speak up in July. And then you could call for an investigation. And then you could basically put Trump on the spot to say, you know, is this true or not? But if he was innocent, Trump would want to clear the air over the very legitimacy of his own presidency. And as long as he doesn't clear the air, it just gets murkier and murkier.
Yeah. The likelihood that he is simply being stubborn seems to diminish by the day. And the probability that something nefarious happened is rising in proportion to the White House denials. And the bungling efforts of the White House are only stirring more doubt and apprehensions. How long this takes, I don't know, but it may be only a matter of a couple more weeks that we discover that there is some kind of financial collusion that was taking place, and that then that metastasized during the campaign into political moves. How much Trump was aware of what any of his subordinates were doing is obviously an open question. But one of the allegations floating around now is that the kind of maneuverings that the Russians were doing during the campaign on Twitter and with fake news are very reminiscent of the same tactics that Paul Manafort used in Ukraine to try and manipulate elections there. So there is definitely going to be a lot to investigate and to ferret out. And I don't think Trump has the slightest desire to have a public airing. On the contrary, as we're seeing, they're trying every measure they can to suppress knowledge about what transpired during this election. They do not want to have the legitimacy of Trump's election seriously questioned. And that is where this is all heading.
But Manafort, apart from taking money from Deripaska, this oligarch who's close to Putin, $10 million a year for a few years to basically be a propaganda outlet for the Kremlin. He also, as we all know, worked for Yanukovych, the ousted kleptocrat from Ukraine, who just the other day, a Russian lawmaker who had defected to Ukraine with his wife, who was also a member of the Duma, they were both part of the Putin inner circle. They knew an awful lot of incriminating stuff. And this Russian lawmaker was about to testify against Yanukovych in a hearing in Ukraine. And he was murdered on the steps of the main hotel in downtown Kiev. So it's not unreasonable to tie Manafort to that, not in terms of authorship of assassination, but by association. I mean, you're working for a horrible kleptocratic thug who the people kicked out, and he's, through whoever, Putin or somebody else, is making sure that nobody can testify against him by murdering them in cold blood in broad daylight. That's the kind of guys you hang out with, Mr. Manafort?
Well, Manafort is not the first DC lobbyist to cater to foreign autocrats, as you know, Ian. But he seems to have taken it to a new level. how much services he actually provided in Ukraine, whether he was simply taking the money and not delivering much is also something that we don't know yet. Whether he should have registered as a foreign agent is being scrutinized. And was he engaged in money laundering? Was this money reported to the IRS? Or was he banking it in one of these bank accounts that he had in Cyprus, which is a haven for Russian money as well? Today it was reported that I believe Manafort had up to 10 accounts in his own name in Cyprus.
Well, Wilbur Ross, who is the Commerce Secretary, co-owned a bank with a Russian gangster and one of the oligarchs who paid about $100 million for a property that Donald Trump's bought for $40 million and sold to this guy for close to $100 million. And it was a total wreck, and the guy actually tore it down. Nobody overpays over almost 200%, well, over 200%, as a matter of fact, for a property, do they? Unless that's a way of laundering money or making a donation, shall we say?
Yeah, the whole Russia thing seems to have had a centrifugal effect in the Trump administration, doesn't it? Who has not been drawn into the vortex? Now we have Jared Kushner who's going to testify. Michael Flynn had to resign as National Security Advisor. Almost no one in the administration seems to be exempt from becoming entangled in this investigation. It has also, I believe, stymied the administration's ability to get any legislation passed. If you notice, the Trump administration has accomplished next to nothing.
Well, just in the last minute, is there a possibility that you were suggesting in weeks' time, the whole horrible, I mean, talk about connect the dots. There are enough dots out there. It shouldn't take long to connect them all. But it's one thing to bring a case against this guy. It's another thing to impeach him. What's your sense of, will he resign or do you have to take it to the impeachment? And an impeachment's a pretty high bar. Even if all these crooks around him are guilty, you still got to prove that he was culpable and was behind it, as opposed to an incidental collection, as they say.
Well, impeachment would take an extraordinary revelation. However, Trump is testing the patience of the House Republicans. Now he said we must fight the Freedom Caucus. The less legislation he produces and the more of a problem he becomes, the less allegiance he will command in the Republican Party. But this is a process that will probably play out over the next year to 2 years. I am skeptical that an impeachment would take place under a Republican Congress. It would, unless some sensational bombshell comes out, which you can't preclude. If it's shown that Trump actively colluded with full cognizance with the Kremlin, I think that would be enough to take him down. But it would not be easy to prove that case unless information is revealed that we simply have no inkling about.
Well, Jacob Halpern, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jacob Halpern, who's a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is Will Pax Germania Replace Pax Americana? We're going to take a brief station break and back look into some of the surprising testimony today about Trump parroting Russian fake news and being susceptible to being fed fake news. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ali Watkins, the Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News. She previously covered national security and regional politics for McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau. And her latest article at BuzzFeed News is Here's Why the House Intel Fight is So Crazy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Watkins.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And Ali, you've been observing the hearings today before the Senate Intelligence Committee, and it's been actually a pretty it looks like they're doing their job studiously. And of course, the chair and the minority chair, or they call him the co-chair in this case, made quite a point of taking to the cameras yesterday to say that they were working in harmony together, in contrast to the House, which is blown up because of the bizarre activities of Devin Nunes, the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee. But I thought that the academics and, with the former head of the NSA, General Alexander, and then a Russian expert from Georgetown, Roy Godson, and then, of course, Gene Rumer from the Carnegie Endowment, who used to be with the CIA, he was also pretty useful, and they laid out a pretty broad landscape. But the one person who caught my attention later on was Clinton Watts, who's a senior fellow at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University. And he pointed out that the Russian interference in our politics are continuing, that just yesterday Senator Rubio was hacked, and Senator Rubio indeed verified that, and that Russian operatives were trying to drive a wedge between Republicans over the health care bill. So how did it strike you? I was surprised at the extent, the persistence, and the aggressiveness of Russian hacking campaign.
Yeah, it was a really important hearing, not for a lot of the reasons I think people expected or wanted, but it provided really important context as we look at this kind of long game with the Russia election interference thing. And part of what was so important, particularly with first panel with Godson and Watts, is that, I think a lot of people look at this Russia election hack as a one-off kind of thing. Like, oh, they hacked the election happened, Trump won, it's over. But what was so important about that first panel is really trying to make people recognize that this was not just a one-time incident. This is a continuing problem. It's going to become an even bigger problem. And we're seeing it continue not just in the U.S., but internationally. In France, in Germany, we had confirmation from lawmakers today that Russia is indeed trying to interfere in the French and German elections. And so a lot of that context about how, like you said, even just yesterday, there were trolls targeting Rubio and really trying to drive a wedge in the healthcare bill. This is a continuing issue of Russian interference in U.S. domestic politics. And I think that was a really important point that was was driven home, I think, throughout this very, very long hearing.
Well, here in California, there is talk of seceding from Donald Trump's America. And while that may be kind of quixotic, it turns out that there is a movement online, the Cal Exit campaign. That's Cal Exit. And guess who's behind that? The Cal Exit campaign. A lot of people have signed up, by the way, thinking, Californians saying, yeah, that's a good idea. I want to leave Donald Trump's America. After all, California is the sixth largest economy. And guess who's behind Cal Exit?
It's pretty incredible, isn't it?
A guy in Russia, for God's sake, So isn't that amazing that this guy called Marinelli is there?
There was a point that came up, I think, either Burr or Warner brought it up, that this is not about the Russians targeting, preferring one party over the other. And a very cogent point was made to me when I first started covering this is that you can't really look at the election operation through a westernized lens. Like, the Russians do not approach these kinds of operations with we do A to get to point B. Like, this isn't a linear operation. They didn't wage the campaign to elect Donald Trump, although that may have been, a part of the grander scheme here. But the ultimate goal is chaos, right? It's sowing chaos in the Western liberal order, and whether that means supporting a secession of California or propping up a proto-nationalist like Donald Trump, it all serves their greater purpose.
Well, the guy that's behind Cal Exit, the Russian, he first moved to Russia. He was a right-wing activist in Buffalo, then he in New York. Then he moved to Russia a decade ago, studied at St. Petersburg State University, and then returned to the United States to campaign against LGBTQ rights as a part of the National Organization for Marriage. And then he returned to Russia and he married a Russian. And then he moved to San Diego, and then he considers himself a Californian because he has an apartment, although he lives in Yekaterinburg, which is a city 1.4 million just east of the Urals. And so, again, it's an extraordinary... let me ask you this. Do you think that Putin is already benefiting from the Trump presidency? Whatever, if indeed there was ever any quid pro quo or any collusion, whatever the deals were, the fact that the country seems to be in such chaos. We have a president with the lowest approval rating in history, and it's going down all the time. Is it possible that he's already won, that the chaos, the division, the anger, the polarization? I mean, everybody that I know is just absolutely outraged about what's happening, and they're very angry. So could that all be a win for Putin?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's possible at this point. Like, this is what the goal was, and it's working. As one of my intelligence sources said to me the other day, Democrats are spinning in circles, Republicans are spinning in circles, and you know who's loving this? Moscow.
So what then do you expect, given the dysfunction of the House Intelligence Committee? In fact, what's your understanding of... My understanding is that, in effect, whether Nunes did it deliberately to torpedo the effectiveness of the House Intelligence Committee or whether he was manipulated by the White House into doing so is open to question. But what is your take on Nunes?
You know, Nunes is this really kind of mystery wrapped in an enigma kind of thing. He's a very strange just personality who has only been the House Intelligence Committee chair for 2 years or so now. Really interesting background, none of it having to do at all with national security or anything related to intelligence. But I think at this point, on a bipartisan basis, what I'm hearing from people is that no one knows how he regains credibility after this. I don't know how you salvage either his own credibility or the credibility of the committee with him as a head.
Well, is it possible, though, that Nunes is a part of the overall pattern in terms of the cabinet where you put an anti-environmentalist in charge of the environment and a guy that is against public housing in charge of HUD, etc.? That's the pattern. Is it possible that this guy...
Oh, absolutely.
...that he's not so bright? So let's put a dumb guy in. Let's put a dumb guy in charge of intelligence. Could it be that cynical?
I mean, he's certainly a Trump ally. He becomes a buffer. Though that comes down to a question of how much pressure House Speaker Paul Ryan is under to keep Nunes in that position, because the White House doesn't ultimately keep Nunes there, obviously. That's a decision that's made on behalf of House leadership. But Ryan has kind of suggested he has full confidence in him. So whether that is a line of communication that's open with the White House to keep Nunes in charge there, I'm not sure. But it's certainly something that's worth looking into.
And again, I'm speaking with Ali Watkins, who's a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News and previously covered national security and regional politics for the McClatchy Newspapers, D.C. Bureau. And her latest article at BuzzFeed News is Here's Why the House Intel Fight is So Crazy. Now, obviously, the effect of whatever Nunes was up to has been to render the House committee pretty useless. And the other rumor that I'd heard is that the White House is really afraid of Adam Schiff because he's very capable, and they're not so worried about the Senate Democratic co-chair, Senator Warner. So I don't know whether that's a sort of cynical possibility, but it's worth noting, though, in terms of the crazy behavior of Nunez in his Uber, going to the White House and then coming back, you know, what he did, in fact, do before he went to the White House is worth noting is he, in fact, he admitted this in his press conference. I first briefed Speaker Ryan. So nothing that he did happened without the blessing of Paul Ryan. So what do you make of that?
I mean, that's kind of like I just mentioned. The real question, Paul Ryan is in charge of either keeping Nunez there or kind of taking him, you know, in the back room and saying, listen, you need to step down. And Paul Ryan has suggested his full confidence in Devin Nunez. And if this happened with the White House effectively communicating to Paul Ryan that there was approval to do this, I mean, we're talking about a bigger issue of conspiracy and cover-up than we've seen in a long time when you're co-opting the Speaker of the House, which we don't know for sure yet. But how Paul Ryan factors into this is going to be a critical part of the story moving forward.
So what do you know is in store for further hearings with the Senate? Because the House hearing was one that I was certainly looking forward to because Sally Yates was going to be on and she was the acting attorney general who was fired by the Trump administration at the time when she basically said that this executive order on the Muslim ban is not going to fly. And they fired her. And of course, she turned out to be right. It's been challenged in the courts. But she was supposed to testify about what the timeline involving Ryan and when he talked to the Russians and when the White House told Pence that he'd been lied to, etc. That was supposed to be something that the White House didn't want to have in the public arena. And also the former head of the CIA, Brennan, was supposed to testify, and the former director of national intelligence, General Clapper, was supposed to testify. Do you think, will they ever show up in the Senate now that Nunez has canceled the hearing and pretty much made the House Intelligence Committee defunct?
Oh, absolutely. I think, if anything, it's positive as for public transparency comes out of this House breakdown. It's that the Senate is more purposed and determined than ever to do this right, I think, and do it in a way that's going to both placate the public and kind of check all of the boxes on their duty list. So I know that the stages that they're kind of going in, they were certainly going in a much more pragmatic, strategic, and slower strategy than the House was. So their plan was to review intelligence community documents related to Russia, which I've heard is just an overwhelming amount of information. Then they intend to interview intelligence community personnel, like Clapper and Brennan, but also workforce-level people who were involved in some of the assessments on the Russian election hacking. And then to finally, the last step, interview Trump affiliates, Trump associates, Trump administration personnel. So they kind of want to go in that order, and they're just wrapping up the initial document review. But I would certainly expect there's going to be public hearings with all of these big names.
And there's a certain anticipation for Jared Kushner and his testimony. But is anybody else from the White House that you know of that is going to be either invited or requested to testify?
You know, I have not heard. We've been very tight-lipped about specific names. As for the current White House, I really don't know because a lot of the people that this scrutiny revolves around is the campaign. And so we're talking, you know, the Paul Manafort, Carter Page, Roger Stone, Mike Flynn, most of whom have already left the White House. Kushner was the first official, I believe, current official to have volunteered. So I'm not sure who else current official-wise would be on that list.
Well, the rumors are, of course, that Mike Flynn is cooperating with the FBI. And if that's true, there's no way in the world he's going to testify, right?
Yeah, I suppose, although that was kind of like dropped out there on Twitter really randomly, and it seems to link back to some commentary piece. It was never clear to me that that was reported out or true.
Right. Well, but would it mean, though, that if he's cooperating witness and he's ratting on everybody else, would they still be able to get him before a closed meeting of the Senate Intelligence Committee, do you think?
I don't know. It's hard to answer a lot of these questions because there's truly no precedent for it. I know that it seems pleasantly surprised with how the FBI is never easy to work with from an oversight perspective, but I know that they've been kind of pleasantly surprised that the FBI has allowed access to certain documents that are involved in an active investigation. Because obviously the CIA or the FBI is under no obligation statutorily, from what I understand, to share information from an open counterintelligence investigation with its overseers. There are certain things that require congressional notifications, but you know, there's a reason the FBI doesn't walk up to the Hill and say, hey, we have an open investigation. Case in point being the Hillary Clinton email thing a week before the election. But I know they've been kind of pleasantly surprised with the FBI allowing access to some of this Trump investigation stuff. So I would assume if Flynn is indeed cooperating, it would be a part of that conversation.
Well, just in closing, Newsweek has a report out now that James Comey, in contrast to the perception that he, what happened with Hillary Clinton, that he's sort of political and secretive, that indeed the Newsweek article saying, no, he's not. He's very open. He's very transparent. He wants to testify. And indeed, back in July, when the first investigations into Russian interference in our elections were emerging on the FBI's radar, he wanted to go public. And guess what? The Obama administration stopped him. I mean, if that's true, boy, did they blow it.
I mean, the great untold story that I fear will continue to go untold in this Russia election thing is how long the Obama administration knew and how long they chose to do nothing. And unfortunately, I think that's a story that has been so steamrolled at this point because of the questions surrounding Trump and connections with Russia. But that is, I think, a massive failing and a really important story that just is does not have the time to be told right now.
Well, Ali Watkins, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ali Watkins, who's a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News. And previously, she covered national security for the McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau. And her latest article at BuzzFeed News is, Here's Why the House Intel Fight is So Crazy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes Podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was